Les colloques du Collège de France.
Our second speaker is Jean-Louis Martin. So Jean-Louis Martin is an emeritus researcher at CNRS. He's affiliated with the Center for Functional and Evolutionary Ecology, CEF, in Montpellier. His areas of interest are community and landscape ecology in their fundamental aspects and in relation to their implications in conservation science. His work focused on how the presence or absence of top predators affects the way their prey affect and perceive the natural landscape. Recently, he has also explored the interface between ecology and public policies. Jean-Louis, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sandra, for the invitation for me to present that talk on the underappreciated consequences of predator absence on ecological interactions. For 400 million years, life built itself around the tension between eating and not being eaten. Until humans decided to change the game, eliminating part of the players. But what does prey tell us even today? Are these big ears to better hear the plants growing? Are these big eyes to better see the plants at night? Are these long legs to better run after the plants that are trying to escape? Not really. It is all about not being eaten. Hence the question of the ecological consequences of eliminating predation risk. Let's start with a little bit of theoretical background. In 1999, Brown et al. Published The Ecology of Fear in the Journal of Mammalogy, providing a solid theoretical background to frame this question. They posed that the presence of predator produces a landscape of risk superimposed to the landscape of resources, and also that the landscape of risk should modify prey behavior, and that changes in prey behavior should affect the vegetation landscape. To test such hypotheses, Haida Gwaii in Western Canada and the adjacent mainland provide a quasi-experimental setup. With four actors, first a deer, the Sitka black-tailed deer, native to the mainland forests, where it lives with wolves and cougar. And then it was introduced to Haida Gwaii in the late 19th century in the absence of its predators, in the absence of severe winters, and in the absence of other large herbivores. Second, we have three landscapes. A landscape of forested islands surrounded by extensive shorelines. Also a landscape of deer presence and colonization history. On the mainland, deer have always been present. On Haida Gwaii, they have been present now for about 100 years, both on the north and southern part of the archipelago. And there is a special area in Laskik Bay where we have a little bit more complex story. We have side by side, circled in red, islands where deer have been present for over 50 years, which has been shown by Bruno Villa using rubbing scars. And we have also a couple of islands circled in blue where deer were present only less than 20 years before the study. And finally, three islands circled in green which have never been colonized by deer. Finally, we have a third landscape, a landscape of varying risk and risk history. On the mainland, deer live with a healthy wolf population, including in Yeo, where we did our study, and also are exposed to some hunting. On Haida Gwaii, on the northern islands, they are exposed to yearly moderate hunting by the local population. In southern Haida Gwaii, they are not exposed to hunting. They are protected from hunting, with a special case in Laskik Bay, where there is no hunting, except for this island, Reef Island, where there was no hunting at the beginning of our research, but where we imposed to the poor deer population an over 90% reduction through hunting of their population to see what would be the response of the habitat to such a reduction in herbivore pressure. So We end up with three interacting and interconnected landscapes, a landscape of resources in the bottom, of habitat and resources, a landscape of deer presence and colonization, and a landscape of risk and risk history. We used two sets of methods to study how risk affected the vegetation and how risk affected deer behavior. To study how risk affected the vegetation, we used standardized vegetation plots in which we recorded the percentage of cover of the species, plant species present in the layer below 1.5 meter, which is the browse line of deer. To study how risk affected deer behavior, we implemented flight initiation experiments that provided us with flight initiation distances of deer and distance traveled by deer in response to an approaching human observer. We also looked at novelty acceptance by deer and their dial activity using camera traps. And we looked at habitat selection of deer, closed forest versus open shorelines, using stable isotopes in bones. The graph here represents the results of a principal component analysis on our vegetation data. The colors refer to the risk treatments, and these colors have been imposed on the graph after the analysis. But what I would like you to retain now is that any plots in this area with a positive score on the first axis is characterized by a vegetation with a high cover of vegetation, mainly a high cover of forbs, deciduous trees, and deciduous shrubs, and a high cover of ferns. Any plot with a negative score on the first axis is characterized by low vegetation cover in all these vegetation categories. And finally, with a negative score on the second axis, any plot with a negative score has a significant cover of grasses and conifers. Let's first look at the islands without deer in orange, so the orange plots. On these islands, the vegetation is characterized by high cover of vegetation and high cover including forbs, deciduous trees and shrubs, and ferns. And the next slide is going just to show a few of the different kind of vegetation types you have on these islands without deer. If we now look at the plots that have been vegetation plots recorded on the islands with deer and no hunting, you can see that they are all characterized by low vegetation cover. In dark green, I have the plots on Reef Island, and on light green, on those of two other islands, East Limestone and Kunga Island. And what you see that all these plots are low vegetation cover, except for three plots which have a little bit more grass and conifer cover. This picture shows you typical understories on islands where you have had deer for over 50 years. To sum up, compared to islands without deer, after a few decades, the presence of deer has reduced understory vegetation cover by about 90% in its diversity. And in addition, we could document a significant reduction in the dark horizon in soils on islands where deer were present for over 50 years. And we also could show that there is a significant delay and or suppression, depending on tree species, in tree regeneration. Sylvain Lombert showed that looking at the effect of the deer presence on understory invertebrates, that when you go from, if you take the one census session, what yields a one census session, if you go from an island with no deer, where you have a lot of species and many individuals per species, to an island where deer were present for over 50 years, you are only left with a few species and usually one or two individuals per species. To sum up for that part of the study, compared to islands without deer, the presence of deer has reduced the abundance of most invertebrate groups by about 90%, their alpha and gamma diversity by about 80%, and greatly simplify their communities. We also looked at songbirds, focusing first on the songbirds that depending on the ground layer and then the shrub layer to feed or breed. And in these birds, again, not too surprisingly, I would say, we also found a decrease in their abundance going from the islands without deer to the islands with deer for more than 50 years. We also looked at the songbird species that depending on the trees and the canopy for breeding or feeding. And for that group, we didn't find any systematic trend with deer presence. So summary for the birds, the presence of deer has reduced the abundance of the understory species by about 50%, their alpha diversity by about 40%, and their reproductive success by about 30%. In the next slide, I'm going to look at the impact of the deer cull I mentioned on Reef Island. Circled in green are the sample, the vegetation sampling plots on Reef Island. And we resampled the very same plots, which were permanent plots, 13 years after the cull. And that's the result. So there is a dramatic increase in most plant covers. And this increase is mainly driven by the recovery of plants, of the few plants that could maintain prostrated browse-resistant individuals. And so now the marked difference with the orange dots on the no deer island, showing that there is a legacy of deer impact in that recovery. Just a few pictures to show the change in reality. Here, after 10 years, you have ferns and shrubs coming back. Here, there is an evergreen shrub coming back. And here is a release of spruce regeneration. We also looked at the response of songbirds. And as you can see, we found a significant increase after 10 years of the songbirds that were most affected by deer presence. Let's put now wolves into the picture. As I told you before, we had a sampling site on the mainland where deer live together with a healthy wolf population and some hunting. So it's represented by these blue dots. And what you see that the vegetation on Yeo is again characterized by high vegetation cover with a significant cover of forbs, but also cover of deciduous shrubs and to some extent ferns. Interestingly, it is in this plant sample that we get something the most similar to the islands without deer. And I illustrate this by these two pictures. On the left, you have a typical understory on an island without deer, on Haida Gwaii. And on the right, a typical understory on the mainland where you have both deer and wolves living together. However, deer maintain high densities on Haida Gwaii and the non-hunted islands, which, as I mentioned, are heavily browsed. So the question is, how is this possible and why? So as I said, the first look, you think there is not much to eat in the understory. But a closer look, as you can see on these two little pictures or the small enclosures, shows that there is a lot of stuff trying to flux of growth that is attempting to make a comeback, but it's readily browsed by deer. And deer also benefit from subsidies in forms of leaves, some conifer trees or deciduous trees, and also in forms of seaweed subsidies from the ocean on the shoreline. So there is enough food, not surprisingly, but it's distributed in small increments across the landscape. And so we hypothesized that it will need more time for a deer to gather its daily ration. Question then becomes where to find the time. And our hypothesis was, is it by reducing anti-predator behavior? Is it by reducing fear? This is a wild animal, by the way. Just so we looked at the results of our flight initiation distance experiments, and we used the contrast to tackle that question, the contrast we had created somehow in deer behavior between the no-risk islands, where it didn't do any treatment, and the reef island, where we had a population that was issued from the survivors to the coal. Looking, comparing these populations in terms of flight initiation distance, what we show is there is a marked contrast between the flight, unquote, and quote unquote, flight initiation distance of the deer on the non-hunted islands, where it's 10 meters or less that they start to move away from the observer. Whereas on Reef Island, for those we could actually spot in the field, so it's a very conservative result. It's closer to 30, 40 meters, getting closer to the standard the mainland references, which are about 60, 70 meter observed in areas with wolves and hunting. If now we look at the distance traveled after flight initiation initiation by the observer, the contrast is even more marked. On the non-hunted islands, deer usually move 5 meters or less away from the observer before they resume their foraging behavior, and they do so just by walking a few steps. On Reef Island, to the contrary, not only do they move further away, usually out of sight, but they do so by running and vanishing in the vegetation. We explored the question of novelty acceptance with two parameters, the easiness, the trap friendliness, the acceptance of traps, which were baited with apples, and the number of minutes spent on baiting stations. In terms of trapping, there is a stark contrast between the islands with no hunting, where we were able to capture a share fraction of the deer present, and for most individuals, we were able to capture them repeatedly, sometimes several times a day for the same individual, which was problematic. On Reef Island, to the contrary, despite the fact that we estimated that there were at least 40 to 45 deer present, and that where we had a very strong trapping pressure, we were only able to capture a small number of individuals, and most of them were never recaptured. Looking at the minutes spent on bait station and the acceptance of bait station on the non-hunted islands, baiting stations were readily accepted, and deer usually spend 5 minutes, close to 5 minutes or more on a station. On Reef Island, they hardly used the baits, and if they were spending time on the flight on the baiting station, it was computed in seconds. Finally, we looked at the change in dial activity in response to risk. On our no-risk deer island, we showed that these animals on non-hunted islands had a very low day-night contrast in activity, with higher activity during daytime, and a pattern of behavior that is very different from what we usually observe on mainlands where you have hunting and predators. Also, looking at the percentage of activity spent at night, we showed that the deer population issued from the culling on Reef Island, and I remind you that it was initially not exposed to risk, became more nocturnal. However, you might have noted that on the islands with no hunting, the amount of standing plant biomass is much lower than on Reef Island, where there is a legacy from the past culls in terms of increased biomass. So to check if there is a potential confounding effect of resources on the pattern we observed, we translocated non-wari animals from Kunga Island, which is resource poor, to Reef Island, which has become resource richer in terms of standing biomass because of the cull. 8 months later, after translocation, we reassessed the behavior of the translocated animals. And on Reef, the Kunga deer that had been moved there had retained their lack of flight response to humans. It's the top figure. They have retained short distances traveled after flight initiation. It's the middle figure. And they have retained their bait acceptance. It's the lower figure, and the local deer on Reef issued from the survivors of the cull had retained their wary behavior that we had identified before. Finally, I mentioned that we also looked at habitat selection, and we were wondering if risk was affecting the use of shorelines. We did that compared to the forest interior, and we did that with a study based on stable isotopes in bone samples. On this graph, I'm showing the proportion of seaweed we were able to identify through these stable isotopes in deer diet and in relation to risk. Framed in blue, you have the three populations not exposed to risk, and in these populations, the proportion of seaweed varies from 19 to 30%. If we look at the populations that are currently exposed to risk or have been exposed to risk in the past, that proportion varies from 8 to 14%. So in sites with wolves and or hunters, deer forage indeed less in the intertidal. However, that trend is still partly correlated with the amount of resources in the understory, so the result should be taken with caution. So what lessons can we draw from the islands? First lesson is that no-risk deer populations are dominated by tame deer in forests simplified by browsing. Our interpretation is that tameness dominance results from a progressive selection of tame individuals better adapted to the progressive change in resources availability, and caused by these progressive change being caused by uncontrolled deer browsing. As tameness spreads, impact on the vegetation increases, selecting for increased tameness, and so on. So that's our interpretation. A second lesson is that risk-exposed deer populations are dominated by wary animals in landscapes where risk prevents overbrowsing. Our interpretation is that only the more wary deer survived the 90% reduction by the cull experiment on reef. And these wary deer still dominate on reef islands several generations after the culls, questioning the heritability of that trait. Other deductions is that the dominance of wariness should be maintained if presence of risk prevents, or top-down control prevents overbrowsing, and also that the expected outcome of such a situation would be high deer density benefiting from high quality habitat, as we suggested in Kirchhoff and Person 2008. To conclude, beyond islands, we were wondering about the kind of conservation and management implication restoration of risk would come with. We know that restoring predator populations affect society. There are negative effects which are easy to assess, like the predation by wolves on livestock, but they can be mitigated by rigorous measures of herd protection. But there are also positive effects to be expected, but these are difficult to document. For instance, on forest regeneration, as for instance by Waller and Rio in 2018, remember that in France, 50% of the forests suffer a deficit of regeneration blamed on high ungulate densities. But positive effects also starting to be documented on livestock health. In Asturias, was observed the doubling of the wolf population on wild boars decreased, the doubling of wolf predation on wild boars decreased bovine tuberculosis incidence in cattle from 17 to about 4%. There are also suspected effects on human health with a suspicion of a link between wolf presence and lower Lyme disease incidence. And also that large predator presence can reduce car collision with ungulates. In France, we have 180 people that are killed or injured every year because of large mammal collision. Okay, last slide is the question about how such knowledge can or does influence public policies. recent legislative initiative promoting killing rather than livestock protection do not suggest so. So these were my 2 seconds of bad mood. And now I just thank you very much and would like to mention that this was a huge team effort, what I presented you today, and also a lot of fun in an increasingly, in an amazingly nice place.
Thank you. Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.